She is this way.
And so Archer went that way. They passed rooms where two uniformed maids were dusting and vacuuming, and apparently getting things just so for the evening. He was deposited into a room nearly as large as a Pope's cathedral, but a bit more welcoming. A fire was lit in a fireplace, cavernous enough for him to stand in. The furniture was costly, elegant, not too much, not too little. He felt like he could breathe in here, unlike back at Mrs. Danforth's place, and not just because of the cats. He saw a stainless steel cocktail bar set up against the wall, with jiggers and tumblers and shakers and a soda dispenser bottle and an ice bucket with a fresh layer of condensation on the sides like downy dew on grass. His lips started moving as he read over the assortment of whiskies, gins, and bourbons. Detecting was thirsty work.
Mr. Archer?
He turned to look at the woman who had appeared in the arched doorway. She was around 40, 5'8", with a blocky build that was well-nourished, a wide face, a long, smooth brow, and a pair of friendly, intelligent blue eyes. Her brown hair was wrapped in an elaborate French braid and draped over one shoulder. Her day dress accentuated her formidable hips. She had on sheer stockings that highlighted her muscled calves and slender ankles. She was an attractive woman who held herself with poise and confidence, though in those blue eyes Archer could detect some nervousness. That could just be because of his line of work. He was rarely around happy people, because happy people were never in need of his services.
Yes, Mrs. Jacoby?
They shook hands, and she said the magic words.
Would you like a drink?
If you're having something. Whiskey and water would be great. No ice. I can mix it. She brought over the two glasses and a stirrer, and Archer did the alchemy, leaving out most of the water. He noted that she opted for a bourbon and soda on the rocks with a wedge of lime. He had watched her make it with a practiced hand. He thought that bar must get a lot of use. Some people just loved alcohol, and also had a happy marriage. They were in the minority, he'd found. They sat in high-backed chairs by the fire.
So, please tell me what's happened to Ellie.
Archer gave her a more detailed account, only leaving out the fact of his falling face first over the body. He was going to take that one to the grave, unless the county cops beat it out of him first. And how do you know her?
We went to college together back in Boston. Then I moved out here and she came later. She went into writing. I went into set design. I work at Warner Brothers.
Archer looked around. Which explains this place. It's got an artist's eye.
I could never afford a home like this on my own, of course. My husband is in finance, and he also comes from money. In fact, this was his parents' home. Simon's firm underwrites a great many film productions. He got into the field because of his father, who was a very successful producer. There were lots of connections available for him, you see.
I absolutely see. Business is good, I take it?
Hollywood is hitting on all cylinders, as my husband likes to say.
Any kids?
Three. The oldest just turned 12.
Nice. You mentioned you and Lamb went to college together back east?
Yes, at Wellesley. I was an art major, and Ellie was an agora.
Archer set his drink down. Art I get, but what's an agora? Sounds like one of those islands in the Caribbean. Jacoby smiled weakly.
She was a history and political science major, and belonged to the Agora Society. They don't have sororities at Wellesley, Mr. Archer, so these college societies became sort of like a sorority would be for us. Before she moved here, Ellie worked in Washington, D.C. as an intern or aide. She's very smart. Very worldly, I guess you can say, unlike me. Her father was in the diplomatic corps. Consequently, she traveled all over. She can speak two or three foreign languages. I think that's why she was in such high demand as a writer. The studios like her Renaissance quality, her je ne sais quoi, if you will.
Now that's a term you don't hear every day. I spoke to Cecily Ransom earlier. She is very concerned about Lamb, and even hired me to find her. Jacoby looked into the fire for a moment, her features distant and opaque.
Cecily's taken Hollywood by storm. She came at a good time. The war was over, and sensibilities and expectations were changing. We came out of that dreadful time a more hopeful, but also a more sober country,
she said, her wide shoulders slumping.
After I came back from the fighting, I wasn't sober for about a year.
She smiled briefly.
But I think people want something new, something different.
And Ransom can deliver that?
She's done over a dozen pictures already, most of them with the major studios, each one more daring and provocative than the last. They sometimes blanch at how far she goes, and won't write the check or allow their stars to appear. And then she just turns to one of the minor outfits and enlists fine actors and gets her films done. They all make money because she has a devoted and growing following, and they get a lot of attention from the press. The studios love free publicity. She directs, too. That is very rare.
Have you done any of her set designs? Jacoby chortled over her bourbon, though he saw there was no corresponding levity in her features.
Our tastes and sensibilities are not simpatico, Mr. Archer. The reality is, my shtick is fairly simple. I do the grand ballrooms, libraries, pools, and lavish bedroom sets. Early on in my career, I cut my teeth on screwball comedies with Ginger Rogers and Fred Astaire and Carol Lombard and William Powell.
She smiled.
I referred to them as gowns and good golly pictures. The cinematic effect was wealth beyond all reckoning, but in the form of a comedy. I mean, no one really lives like that.
Archer made a show of looking around and said, "Could have fooled me." She flushed at his words, but then smiled and said,
"Touché."
"Hey, live and let live. And if you work for Warners, I know you work hard."
The sets are wonderful to create. I could live out every fantasy I had.
She glanced up at him before continuing.
I guess you would be surprised to know that I grew up in a small town in West Virginia, where my father was a coal miner, and we lived in a shack in the hollers.
Archer lifted his eyebrows. You've come a long way from a valley in West Virginia, and I don't hear any accent.
I spent a lot of money getting rid of it. People do that here, you know.
Do what?
Reimagine themselves. When I was a little girl, I would go to the one little store in town and leaf through the fashion and movie magazines and dream about something better.
Her voice trailed off, and she looked down into her bourbon like maybe other dreams were hiding in there for her to find. Archer let her hang out there for a moment. He appreciated the background information she had just given him, without his having to ask a single question. He had learned that silence was sometimes a PI's best tool. And the more he learned about Lamb's friends, the more ultimately he would learn about her. But he felt he had figured out something about Jacoby already. An image appeared in his mind, prompted by her name. Alice in Wonderland. She's going down every rabbit hole looking for something that she doesn't have. And she'll keep doing it until her last breath. And Cecily Ransom's work? Prompted Archer, finally.
Her stories are gritty and, to put it bluntly, shorn of all decoration. She's an actor's director, meaning the story is absolutely centered on their performances and the dialogue, not the accoutrement that I typically provide.
She looked off for a moment, as though she was seeing things she didn't want to necessarily confront.
She represents a new age, at least for women. I think she has a shot at being one of the great ones when all is said and done.
And her partner, Bert Green? Archer noted that the woman changed color and took a quick sip of her bourbon before answering.
I've worked in this town for nearly 20 years, Mr. Archer, and they are one of the oddest business couples I've ever seen. Don't get me wrong. Bart Green has been immensely successful. But let's just say his bread and butter is what Hollywood has been churning out for decades. Nothing daring. Nothing that would shock a grandmother's sensibilities. And he has made a fabulous living doing so.
But he doesn't quite have the je ne sais quoi of Cecily Ransom.
No, he doesn't. Hence my description of them as an odd couple.
So why do you think they ended up as business partners?
Bart Green may have a meat-and-potatoes idea of what films can and should be, but he is also very canny and quick to spot talent. I think he knows that in the very near future, the sorts of films he has the wherewithal to make will no longer be popular. And he also knows that Cecily's films will not only appeal to the new audiences coming to the theaters, but will also be award winners and stand the test of time. In this little town, Oscar is solid gold in more ways than you can count. Did you know that they're going to televise the Academy Awards for the first time ever this year?
No, I didn't. But I'm not in the business. She said wistfully.
Bart has all the money he needs. Now he just wants a fitting legacy. At least that's my take. So he brought Cecily in, and she has a free hand to do what she wants.
And you got all this from her or Lamb? Asked Archer.
Mostly from Ellie and a few others. But Cecily and I are acquaintances as well. At least I hope she regards me as such.
She added. Archer cocked his head. He wasn't in the business per se, but he had been around the film world long enough to have figured some things out, and he could read people better than most. Do I see a desire to build bare bones, deeply in the background so actors can emote set designs on a Cecily Ransom bohemian production one day? She smiled coyly and raised her glass to him.
My, my. I've been married for over 13 years, and my dear husband would have no idea what you're even talking about.
You said you hadn't seen Lamb for a week, but had you spoken to her after that?
Yes, a few times. We were actually supposed to have lunch tomorrow at the Warner's commissary.
She sound okay?
Yes. Nothing out of the ordinary. Nothing that would explain what has happened.
Archer took the matchbook out. You ever been to the Jade Lion Bar with her? She blinked rapidly.
The Jade Lion Bar? Where is it?
Chinatown.
I don't go to Chinatown, Mr. Archer, and I don't know anyone who does. I don't believe it's safe for people like me.
Well, speaking on behalf of people like me, I've been there. It's not that bad. And your friend had a half dozen of these in her desk drawer.
I don't know why she would have them.
Okay. Do you know a Jonathan Brewster? He asked.
Jonathan Brewster? No, I've never heard of him.
Do you have a recent snapshot of Lamb?
Why?
She said sharply. Well, when a person is missing, it's helpful to have a picture of her I can show around to see if someone has seen her. He'd meant to ask Ransom for one, but had forgotten, and he'd found none at Lem's house, which was curious in itself.
Oh, of course. Give me a moment.
While she was gone, Archer walked over to the wall next to the fireplace and eyed the long, framed photo there. The caption read, Wellesley, Class of 1934. He scanned the rows of smiling women. There was a younger and thinner Alice Jacoby, beaming away and looking like the sun would never set on her dreams. And to her left, and one down from her, was the diminutive Eleanor Lamb. She was blonde, with what looked to Archer to be natural curls. And she wasn't smiling. Jacoby walked back in and handed him the snapshot. It was her and Lamb, arm in arm. The background was the Pacific, and there was sand under their feet. They were dressed in jeans and matching white cable knit sweaters.
That was taken last January.
Malibu? Said Archer. She gave him a surprised look.
Yes, that's right. How did you know?
Just a lucky guess. Thanks. I may be back for some more questions, if that's okay.
Oh, yes, anything to help.
She took out a business card from her dress pocket.
Here's my number at Warner's. I'm usually there during the week.
He left without need of the hinged butler leading him. He climbed into the Delahaye and looked at the photo once more. Jacoby was again beaming. She did it quite well, he had to admit. Eleanor Lamb, on the other hand, looked like she wanted to murder someone, which made Archer wonder if the worldly writer with a Wellesley degree had. Chapter 19. Archer drove back to Callahan's and found a note inside saying that she had slipped out to run some errands and would be back around 6:30, and what did he want to do for dinner? He called Willie Dash's office, and this time the man himself picked up. Willie, it's Archer.
I was hoping it would be you. Now I want to hear everything you told Connie, plus everything else you've found out since you talked to her. I doubt you've been dragging your feet. If anything, you sometimes move too fast.
Archer complied, ending on his conversation with Alice Jacoby.
Malibu, Bel Air, and Beverly Hills, huh? You're running in some high circles, Archer, and some dangerous ones.
It's not by choice.
It was your choice to hustle work in L.A. and to take this case.
True.
I know Phil Oldham. He'll seem like a nice guy right before he rips your heart out and drops you in a cell for nothing much. You watch yourself around him and his boys.
I will.
Connie told me about the guys you ran into on the beach.
Yeah, I was just wrong place, wrong time. Has to be smugglers, don't you think?
They used to be gun and rum runners in Malibu years ago, especially during Prohibition. Hell, Ramirez Canyon used to be called Whiskey Gulch. I'll let you figure that one out. The whole coast down there was a smuggler's paradise. Portuguese Bend, Rancho Palos Verdes. The mother boat stays out to sea, and they run the small fast boats to shore with the stuff and a lot of manpower. Quick in and out.
Sounds exactly like what I saw last night.
You were lucky, Archer. You might not be so lucky next time.
I'm not going after smugglers. Just a missing writer.
So the Jade Lion Bar.
You know it? Said Archer.
I don't have to. I got nothing against the Chinese. But you can't go in there thinking normal rules apply, because they don't. 34 years ago, you had opium dens and gambling houses and whorehouses and Tong warfare all over. That's been cleaned up since they knocked down old Chinatown to build Union Station, and they all got moved to what used to be Little Italy a mile away. Now the place has nice shops and restaurants and nice people living and working there, just like they do in other communities. But just like in other communities, you got good, and you got not so good, and you got really bad. And the really bad places all have the same M.O.
Namely?
Their side business is selling one thing, booze, food, medicine. Their main act is always selling something else, and it's the something else that breaks a book's worth of statutes.
Well, Lamb might have been a frequent visitor to it.
I understand your interest.
Did you find out anything on Cedric Bender?
He's in our line of work, Archer.
You mean he's a P.I.?
And apparently a respected one. I got a physical description for you.
Archer heard paper rustling. Dash said,
5'10", heavy set, thinning gray hair, in his 50s.
That matches the dead guy. And his car is missing, too.
So the questions are, who killed him, where, and why? And what did they do with his ride?
He had to have a connection to Lamb.
Why? I found him in her house. You can't jump to that conclusion. Someone could have dumped his body there to incriminate her.
I actually fed that line to Oldham. He didn't bite on it.
And the guy who answered the phone couldn't be Bender. He was already dead.
Maybe it was the guy who killed him.
Killers don't normally answer phones. And since it looks like he was killed elsewhere, chances are they dumped him there for some reason. And that reason isn't good for Lamb, since it's put the county cops right on her doorstep. She may have gone on the run, and she might not be running just from the likes of Phil Oldham.
Or else she's dead. And then there's the matter of who knocked me out.
Could have been the guy who answered the phone, or it might have been Lamb. Big enough sap and enough motivation, even a lady could lay your butt out, Archer.
Makes me wonder why they didn't finish the job with me.
Could be simple. They had one body to deal with and didn't want another one.
So you think whoever killed Bender is trying to frame Lamb?
Considering they're the world's biggest ocean right next door to dump him in, but used her home, sweet home, instead, it's a plausible theory. What's your next move?
I've got one lead to follow up with. Then I'm going to hit this Jade Lion Bar tonight and see what shakes out.
You want me to come down?
I can handle it for now. When I can't, you'll be the first to know.
How's Liberty?
If anything, even more beautiful.
Oh, Archer. You got it so bad, son.
Chapter 20. Archer put the phone down and looked at his watch. It was almost 6. He scribbled a note to Callahan and went back out to the Delahaye. He drove to Bolero's and parked on the side street to hide it from sight, since Ransom had already seen the car. He passed by competing billboards for the Roy Rogers TV show and Gene Autry's program. Both men were in their full frontier regalia. Rogers held a pearl-handled six-shooter, while Autry brandished a fancy guitar. There wasn't a speck of dust or dirt on their colorful cowboy duds. Their smiles were sparkling white, even in the growing gloom. This made him think of Jacoby's comments on maybe a more sobering and substantive dawn coming for the country. Well, Archer, for one, thought it was long overdue. He walked into Bolero's and looked around. It was pretty much like every other dive bar he'd been in. Wooden stools worn down by drunken butts, a slick, scarred bar with a string of names either carved by knife or via the long fingernails of the inebriated, a few rickety tables, a scattering of more private booths, three-tiered rows of bottles behind the bar, and cigarette smoke grazing the ceiling like trapped clouds. The only things that looked out of place were a battered and dusty black baby grand piano with fake gold trim by the window, and a cadaverous old man, dressed in a tux from the early 40s with a tacky white carnation pinned to his lapel, sitting at the piano. He had a toothpick dangling from bloodless lips, and an old bowler hat pushed back on his mostly bald head. He was pecking out an Andrews Sisters tune that was impressing truly nobody, not even him. When someone dropped a dime into the neon jukebox and Eddie Fisher came on to sing "Tell Me Why," the cadaver got up to hit the men's room. The bar wasn't crowded yet, but Archer knew that would change, particularly on a holiday. L.A. liked its booze, and a place to sit and drink that was not home, particularly if you were married and your wife didn't understand you. He picked the booth that would allow his back to be to the door, but also have him facing the mirror over the bar, enabling him to see anyone coming in. The woman who escorted him to that booth asked for his drink order. She was petite, in her early 20s, brown-haired, slim-hipped, and full of spunky attitude. "Make it a cup of coffee black to start, and we'll go from there. And make sure it's fresh."
"Oh, what a dream customer you are."
He slipped the woman a five, and she clammed up and went away to fetch the coffee. Archer kept his hat on to hide the bandage. He got his coffee, which was good and hot, and watched as it started to rain, the chilly drops pitter-pattering the glass like liquid bullets. Archer suddenly remembered he hadn't had any food since his noontime breakfast. "What do you have to eat in this place?" he asked the waitress. She leaned down with a pouty look and said,
"Sandwiches, potato chips on the side, and a fat pickle."
"Any good?" She put her elbows on the table.
"Tell you what, Dreamy. For another five, I'll grill the rye and make it myself with love and kisses. A Reuben do it for you? We got real Russian dressing."
"Sold. But go light on the Russian dressing."
"Why?"
"Haven't you heard? We're in a cold war." He ate while the rain drizzled down. The Reuben was warm and excellent, and Archer ate fast. He was finishing his last potato chip when at 7 on the dot, he saw her glide in. Cecily Ransom hadn't changed clothes since he'd seen her before, only now she was wearing a man's black fedora and a dark peacoat with a white scarf, because the rain had dropped the temperature. With the coat and her hair hidden inside the hat, she could have easily been mistaken for a man. She lowered her umbrella, looked around, and walked over to a corner booth on the other side of the room. The jukebox had gone quiet for the moment, but the cadaver had come back from an extended performance in the John and was doing an Irving Berlin tune. Badly. The growing number of people around the bar, both young and old, took turns glancing his way and probably wondering what the hell he was even doing here. Then the cadaver stopped plunking keys. To Archer's surprise, he walked over and sat down across from Ransom. They immediately started talking in low voices. When his waitress came by, Archer said, "What's with the piano player?" She followed his gaze.
"We don't have a piano player. At least not anymore. Guy we had quit months ago. They don't pay nothing and the tips are lousy. And we got the jukebox now. They just don't want to pay to have the piano moved out of here is all."
"So what's with that guy?"
"He just walked in tonight and started playing."
"And nobody thought to ask him why?"
"Hey, it's not my problem. If the guy wants to play, what's the big deal?"
"He a regular?"
"What's it to you?"
"Just to remind you, Angel, I paid you $10 for a $1.50 meal and 30 cents worth of coffee. Can I at least get a passable return on my investment?"
"Okay, okay. I've never seen him before."
"That's better. You know the lady?"
"She's been in a couple of times."
"Alone or with someone?"
"Alone. Hey, how was the sandwich?"
"Much better than the pickle." She blew him a kiss.
"That's what they all say, Dreamy. See, I don't make the pickles.
A while later, Ransom leaned across the table and gave Cadaver a hug and a peck on the cheek before she left. When the old man exited a minute later, Archer followed him out into the rain. Chapter 21. Ransom must have either driven to Bolero's or gotten into a cab, because Archer didn't see her in any direction. Archer tugged up the collar on his jacket and angled his hat down farther over his face as the L.A. rain splattered over him. Cadaver was up ahead and walking slowly. He didn't seem in a hurry to get out of the inclemency, and Archer wondered why. And he also wondered what he and Ransom had been talking about. He was obviously the man she'd arranged to meet during the call he'd overheard from her office, a call in which Archer's name had been prominently mentioned. So that led him to suspect he wasn't uselessly chasing his shadow down a one-way street. But the kiss and hug at the end had surprised him. He didn't quite know what to make of that. Cadaver surprised him again when he suddenly turned and walked directly up to Archer.
You must be Mr. Archer. Name's Sam Malloy.
He put out a pale, veined hand, which Archer shook.
Little cafe around the corner. Know you already had coffee back at Bolero's, but I could use one. At my age, this chill gets right in your bones. I don't like L.A. this way. I only like the weather they have on the brochures. Sunny all day, every day.
Archer followed him around the corner, and they got seated at a table near the back. Malloy took off his hat and set it on the chair next to him, while Archer studied the man. He had tiny lines stamped all over his face. They were of such fine detail that any cartographer would have been proud to claim ownership. His face was hairless, and he had no eyebrows. The eyes were a translucent blue that made his skin seem paler still. There was a discernible edge of spirited life in his manner, and intelligence in the man's alert eyes. But Archer also saw in them pain, a bit of dread, and finally, resignation. It was a lot to ask from a pair of eyes, he knew, but the man's pupils somehow managed to deliver. They ordered coffees and waited in silence for them to arrive. The rain picked up outside, and they could see people scurrying along to get out of it. What's with the tux? Asked Archer when the waitress had departed after delivering their drinks.
I like to dress up when I go out, though I don't much go out anymore.
And the piano picking?
Gave me a chance to watch you without you thinking I was a threat, or that I was waiting for someone like Cecily to show up. Plus, I used to be a good keep-lunker, although the arthritis has pretty much done me in on that score.
Then you played your part well, because you had me snookered.
You smoke?
Malloy asked Archer. Archer nodded and drew out his pack. He offered one to Malloy, who shook his head.
My health, what's left of it, no longer permits. But I do enjoy seeing a man smoke. And drink, because I can no longer do that either. What's left in life after that, I'm not sure.
You got health problems?
Any man my age who does not have health problems is dead, Mr. Archer.
Archer lit up and said, Just make it Archer, Sam. Can you tell me how you knew who I was? Ransom never spotted me, I know that for sure.
I like to get to places early. Cecily has an eye for detail, and she had told me of your distinctive car. I spotted it passing by, saw you drive around the corner, and then walk to the bar.
Did you tell her I was there?
No, Cecily has enough on her mind.
And how do you know her?
She's my grandniece.
Okay.
And I am, or rather was, with the LAPD. Started on the force longer ago than I care to remember, and worked my way up to detective before retiring. I say this with the utmost candor and pride. I was one of the honest ones. Back then, we were few and far between. I could have spent my entire career arresting people who carried the same badge I did.
Archer tapped his ash into the glass bowl on the table. I believe that. So she called you to meet after I spoke with her.
And you must have overheard her conversation.
Something like that, yes.
I made some calls about you, Archer. You work with Willie Dash up in Baytown, correct?
Why ask if you already know?
Just the old cop and me. He and you have excellent reputations.
Willie's as good as they come, and taught me the same. But why did Ransom phone you?
Isn't it obvious? She is concerned about Eleanor Lamb. I'm the only person connected to law enforcement whom she knows. She wanted my advice.
And what did you tell her? Malloy sipped his coffee.
How long have you been around Los Angeles?
About 3 years, but some days it feels like 30. Malloy nodded and put his cup down.
I've been here my whole life, and I have yet to even begin to understand what really makes this town tick. On a superficial level, of course, the analysis is easy. Money, power, fame. In that regard, it's much like any other city. But it also has the added element of Hollywood, which makes it totally unique, with a criminal element that is dead set on exploiting those in the movie business to the utmost degree and for myriad reasons. Thus, while the disease is easy to diagnose, its mutating variations are not so easily discerned, because they change so rapidly. And that makes a cure nearly impossible.
Archer looked bemused. I feel like I'm back in college listening to professors pontificating, but I usually came away from those lectures wondering what the hell they actually meant. So if you'd care to simplify, it's just a request. I can't make you. Malloy rested his bony elbows on the table.
Ben, let's get down to it. I spoke with some folks I know at the county sheriff's office, and what they tell me is that the man found dead in Eleanor Lamb's house was a private investigator named Cedric Bender from Anaheim.
Archer didn't bother to feign surprise, because Malloy didn't look like he would have believed it. How did they track him down?
They didn't have to. Someone at the county recognized him when his body was brought into the morgue.
Okay. Where does that take us?
Bender had a good reputation. He was a careful man. The fact that this happened to him means we are not dealing with the usual sort of snot-nosed riff-raff running around playing tough guy.
Archer rubbed the back of his head. Yeah, I figured that out too. Not that I ever really thought that was the case.
PIs, as I'm sure you know, do not usually snoop around the house of their employer, so it is doubtful that Bender was working for Lamb.
Well, considering she wanted to hire me, I tend to agree with that. Most people only need a single gumshoe, and they grouse about paying one bill, much less two. But what if he was killed elsewhere and dumped there as a warning to her? Malloy looked intrigued.
Do you think that's what happened?
I know you told me who you are, but you got some ID that shows you used to be a cop? Malloy took a wallet from his pocket and removed from it a card.
I kept this when I retired. My badge, of course. I had to turn in.
Archer examined the card and then handed it back. Okay. Lamb told me about a blue Ford that was parked on her street. She was concerned someone was watching her. I saw the car and checked the registration. It was Bender's ride.
And if she had hired Bender, she would have known it was his car?
That's what I'm thinking, said Archer.
So placing his body at her home was a warning to her, you were suggesting?
A stiff in your house will scare anyone.
But what was Lamb involved with that required her to be warned in such an extreme manner?
Mused Malloy. If I knew that, this thing would practically solve itself. You said Ransom is your grandniece, and you've been in L.A. all your life. But she's a recent arrival?
Her mother is my brother's daughter. They live back east. Cecily graduated from college there and came here to make films. She's doing very well.
So I heard. He hunched forward. Can I ask a candid question?
What other types of questions should a detective ask?
In hair and dress, Lamb is, albeit on a smaller frame, a carbon copy of Ransom, eccentric, so to speak. Two dark, moody straight hairs and a wavy blonde cutie pie Hollywood pond. Anything else there I should know about?
In what way?
In any way. Malloy pressed his pale lips together tightly for a moment.
While I am of a generation that does not condone those who are attracted to the same gender, this town is full of them. Thus, I can neither confirm nor deny what you are so obviously thinking, Archer.
And would you have a problem if Cecily falls outside of the conventional?
Cecily has always fallen outside of the conventional. That's why she has become as successful as she has. In case you're wondering where my loyalties lie, I am immensely proud of her. And while I admit that I would prefer that she adopt a more traditional approach when it comes to matters of the heart, I have seen enough of life to know full well that my fellow human beings come in all sorts of packages and desires. My dear wife would be horrified to hear what I am saying, which is why I never say it to her.
What else did you tell your grandniece?
She told me that she had retained you to find Lamb, and after I checked into it, I informed her that she was in good hands.
You two could have done all of that over the phone.
Yes, but I wanted to see her. She's very busy, as young people so often are, while I have nothing to do except sit and wait for my time on Earth to end. I can't see her face over the phone, and I wanted to see her face.
Archer nodded. And thanks for the vote of confidence.
What's your next move?
The Jade Lion Bar in Chinatown. Lamb seems to have been a frequent visitor there.
I almost died twice in raids we made on some Tong gangs in old Chinatown back in the 20s. Kill you as soon as look at you.
And New Chinatown has some wild parts to it, under the Hollywood facade.
People are people. So whether it's old or new, some of them like things on the wrong side of the law, and always will.
He tapped a bony finger against the table.
So you have no idea what Lam is mixed up in that could cause her to believe that her life was in danger?
Not yet. Did you ever meet her? Asked Archer.
Twice. Once at a party Cecily invited my wife and me to, and another time at a movie premiere, where I loved her film without really understanding a bit of it.
So what was your take on Eleanor Lam? The pale blues suddenly took on a fiery spark, like living, pulsating Bunsen burners.
For what it's worth, I didn't like her, Archer. I would never trust her. And I don't think you should, either.
Chapter 22. It was 10 o'clock, and the chilly rain was persisting, when Archer walked through the west gate on Hill Street and entered Chinatown. A dull crack of lightning speared toward the earth nearby and was followed by a hollow sound of thunder. The new year seemed to be looking for trouble as it stumbled out of the starting gate. As Willie Dash had alluded to, the current Chinatown had sprouted up after the original Chinatown had been bulldozed to make way for Union Station. Filmmakers and set designers had helped create the look of the new Chinatown, and thus Archer passed by a veneer of architecture that one might have seen in Hollywood pictures about China. To him, it deprived the place of any real, granular identity. He passed dragons on walls, Chinese characters graffitied all over, and locked roll-up gates in front of shops because thefts and burglaries happened here just like everywhere else. The streets were mostly empty. A few bikes splashed down the street. He saw a car turning left, its brake lights burning the rain the color of fire. He saw only Chinese people, who gave his white face wondering looks before hurrying onward in the rain. The Jade Lion was a 4-story brick building that sat robustly in a corner lot at an intersection that was neither major nor insignificant. The eponymous lion in the form of a greenish marble statue stood guard outside the bar's garishly red-lighted exterior. It looked angry and patient all at the same time, as though just waiting for a passerby to make a mistake before pouncing. A white man in a gray suit was standing in profile under the bar's narrow covered entrance, smoking a cigarette, so Archer couldn't get a good look at him. But he noted the Chinese man standing next to him was wearing colorful garb, including a close-fitted, fur-lined cap. On the man's belt was an empty knife holder, made of what looked to be bronze. Archer wondered where the knife was. As Archer headed up the sidewalk, the man in the suit turned and quickly went back inside. The Chinese man stepped forward to block Archer's path. He was heavy-set with no neck and a long, stringy mustache that bracketed his mouth.
Yes?
I'm here for a drink.
Name?
Why? Is that required to get a whiskey and soda in this place?
Name?
John Smith, replied Archer.
Many men who come here have that name.
I bet. He took out the book of matches. I have this. I'd like to return it to a friend. They might be inside. The man glanced down at the matches, and his expression changed to one of interest.
Who is your friend?
I'd like to keep that to myself.
You police?
No.
You do not carry a gun, do you, mister?
I do not, said Archer. The man searched him expertly, from his chest to his hips, then moved aside and held the door open for him. Archer said, If I didn't have the matches in the name and I had a gun, would you let me in? The man smiled without showing his teeth.
Enjoy your time here, Mr. Smith.
Archer pulled out the photo of Lamb and showed it to him. You ever seen her here?
My memory is no good. I will forget you when you step inside the door.
Archer said, Is that for when the police come looking and you deny having seen me? The man let the door go, turned back to the street, and watch the rain fall. Archer moved through the door, and his nostrils immediately ran into the aroma of heavy incense, and his ears bumped into a sea of intriguing noises coming from every direction. He entered a small foyer and looked around. There were multiple beaded doorways leading down other corridors. He had an inkling the jade lion would resemble a rabbit's warren inside a maze, encased in a labyrinth, all outlined in indecipherable Chinese. Archer had worked cases in Chinatown before. He had found that the people here didn't relinquish their secrets easily, and usually not at all. It wasn't that they were naturally unfriendlier than anyone else. They had just been burned a few times too many by people who looked just like Archer. And when people didn't treat you like you were human, there was no possibility of trust or engagement. But still, he was a PI working a case, so he had to try. From another beaded doorway appeared a woman. She was in her early 20s with black hair cut close to her small, oval, and painted face. She wore a tight-fitting yellow dress with red embroidery across its front in the shape of a dragon. She had on red heels and no stockings.
Drink, mister?
He looked around. Yeah, is there a bar? Or did I read the sign outside wrong? She pointed at the beaded doorway to his left.
That way, honey.
They have good drinks here?
That way, honey.
Archer took out the photo and showed it to the woman. Indicating Lam, he said, Have you ever seen her here before?
That way, honey.
Archer put the photo away and smiled down into a petite face framed with large dark eyes, topped by fake lashes so long it looked like someone had glued spiders to the lids. He pointed to the beaded doorway. Let me get this straight. That way, honey? She smiled and walked through another set of beads, swishing her full hips just so as she did. She had a tattoo on her muscular left calf. It was a long-bladed knife, with drops of blood on it. Well, that was charming, he thought, as he pushed through his own set of beads in search of the bar. And Eleanor Lam, alive or dead. Chapter 23. Down a short hall was the bar. It was not like any bar of Archer's acquaintance, certainly not like the over-the-top Coconut Grove. It was not even like the decrepit Boleros. While it was small, dark, and dingy, with a gummy plank floor, it also held splashes of color in the form of wall-sconce lampshades and puffy balls tied to the ceiling, and framed Chinese-inspired masks behind the bar. Elaborately clothed and face-painted barmaids carried drinks on round trays to thirsty customers. There were no mirrors, no rows of bottles, no jukebox, no grand piano. No tables or bar stools either. Folks were either standing at the small wooden counter or else in the middle of the room in groups of two or three chatting quietly. A quick sweep of the area told Archer that he was the only white man in the place. The customers here were of various ages and sizes and dressed in everything from three-piece pinstripe suits to long embroidered robes. The drink glasses they held weren't big. In fact, they were all thimble-sized. To a person, they all turned and looked at him as he invaded their little domain. He walked up to the bar, found a slot in between a tall, lean man wearing a scarlet embroidered robe and a chubby man in a two-piece seersucker suit and a dark-colored shirt. Chubby's face was growing jowls, and the space over his mouth was trying and failing to birth a mustache. The man smiled, revealing enough gold fillings and caps to allow Archer to retire if he could find a way to extract them. The robed man sipped his drink and did not look Archer's way. He bent over his glass as though he were saying a prayer. If so, Archer hoped it wasn't for him. The bartender, a giant dressed in a long cloth robe the color of grain and would have looked perfectly at home in an arena wrestling a rhino, walked slowly over, cleaning a glass with a rag. He eyed Archer but said nothing. Can I get three fingers of whiskey with a splash of soda, pal? Archer said. The man looked him up and down, then walked away to discuss something with another gentleman, who was apparently more to his liking. The suit next to Archer said, They don't serve whiskey here, fella. How about gin? The man shook his head and showed his gold again. Rum, bourbon, vodka? The man just kept shaking his head. No, nothing like that. I thought this was a bar. Do they serve any alcohol, or should I ask for milk? Tell him you want this. He held up his thimble glass. And what is that?
Baiju. It's what we all drink.
Archer looked at the robed man, who was staring at his empty thimble glass like he was wondering where his baiju had gone. The suit waved to the bartender, who came back over. He didn't look at Archer. The suit said,
"He wants the usual."
The giant walked away, picked up a bottle from below the counter, and poured some liquid into a thimble glass. They brought it back over to Archer and said something in Chinese. Archer looked at the suit.
"He wants payment, fella. $2 American.
"For that?" said Archer, staring at the tiny glass.
"It's what you Yanks like to call quality, not quantity."
Archer passed $2 across, and the giant drifted away. Suit raised his own glass and said,
"To your health."
"How do you drink this thing? Fast or slow?" The gold smiled at him.
"We do it as a shot, as you Yanks say, but I think you might want to take it slow, fella."
The suit drank his in one tipped-back swallow. Archer sniffed the liquid and was surprised that it held no odor familiar to him, that the smell was very distinct. It was also clearer than any water he'd ever seen.
"It is an ancient process in China to make baiju," explained the suit, wiping his mouth. "Very labor-intensive. Americans cannot make it. The fermentation is the tricky part. It comes in different varieties. You can tell which by smell. Light, medicinal, spicy, sesame, extra strong. We are lucky Jade gets some. This is why we come here."
Archer took a sip, and it immediately felt like he had swallowed liquid fire. As it went down his throat and landed like an inferno in his belly, the fire turned to something else, and he thought he might be sick. He put one hand against the bar and closed his eyes, steeling himself to not vomit or pass out. In about 10 seconds, the twin sensations passed. He turned to the suit and croaked,
"Impressive that you can slam this back, buddy."
It wasn't just impressive, he thought. It was a damn miracle. As he looked around at the others, young and old, tossing their thimbles back and going on with their conversations as though they hadn't just sucked down a flaming sword, the idea of Americans being the hardiest people on earth simply faded from Archer's mind.
"It is an acquired taste. This version is 45% alcohol. Please tell me that's the extra strong one, because another sip and I'd be squiffed."
The suit shook his head.
"Pretty mild, actually. We Chinese do business around drinking, usually with baiju. We feel it makes the true self come out, and we like to truly know who we do business with. Ha ha!"
Archer coughed and cleared his throat. "Speaking of business," he took out the photo. "You ever see this woman in here before?" He pointed to Lam. The suit glanced at the photo and grinned in gold once more.
"No, mister. Who is she?"
"A friend I'm looking for."
"I cannot help you."
"Okay." Archer showed the picture to everyone else there and got no replies in return, only blank stares. He didn't know if it was the baiju or just him. He turned to leave. The suit said,
"You won't finish your baiju? It is bad form."
"Better form for me if I don't."
"You are leaving the jade?"
"I am leaving the jade," Archer lied. He exited the bar area and made his way back to the front room. The woman who had been there earlier had not returned. He looked out the front to see the Chinese gent open the rear door of a sleek silver Rolls Royce. Out from it stepped a platinum blonde whom Archer recognized as a famous actress, although he couldn't remember her name. She wore dark glasses and had a hat and fur stole that partially obscured her features. But she had lowered the glasses for a moment, and that was when he recognized her. She headed up the steps, and Archer quickly looked around. There was a 3-panel leather room divider set in one corner he had noticed before. He slipped behind that and almost stumbled over some boxes stacked there. He positioned himself so that he could see through one of the narrow openings between the panels. The actress came in and was immediately greeted by the same woman in the yellow dress. She had appeared so quickly, Archer assumed she had been watching from a window somewhere and had seen the woman's arrival too. She didn't point out the beaded doorway to the bar. She instead took the woman's coat, hat, and glasses and escorted her through another beaded opening. The actress kept her gaze on the floor. She looked like she didn't want to be there, and so Archer wondered why she was. He waited for a few moments to see if the yellow dress appeared. She did, and then vanished through another beaded gateway. This place really was a maze, he thought. If there was ever a fire here, Everyone was going to die. Archer had started to step out when his foot slipped on something on the floor. He bent down to see what it was. The particles were small and gritty. Sand. He took another look at the boxes. They seemed familiar to him, but crates like these were all over town. He felt along the sides of them. They had gritty sand stuck in some of the crevices, and bits of it had fallen to the floor. He lifted the top off one. It was empty. He put the top back in place and checked to make sure the room was clear before stepping out. He passed through the same doorway the actress had. After a right turn, he came to a long hall that had doors set on both sides. They had little slips of paper with numbers on them set in brass holders. He gently tried the door marked number one. It was locked, and someone from inside the room called out, "It's taken! Scram!" He did that four more times until he came to one that wasn't locked. As soon as he eased it open, he heard someone coming. He ducked inside and closed the door behind him. A few moments later, footsteps hurried down the hall. "They're looking for someone, and I think it's me." He hadn't brought his flashlight, and he didn't want to risk turning on a light. There were no windows in the room, so the only illumination came from the small gap under the door. He let his eyes adjust to the absence of light and looked around. There was a bed, a nightstand, and a large armoire with Chinese symbols carved on it. And there were mirrors on all the walls, and when he looked up, he was staring at a dim reflection of himself and the room, because there were mirrors up there, too. The only part that wasn't glassed in was where a heavy chandelier was located. Narcissus would have loved this place. He opened the armoire, and inside was some of the gaudiest women's lingerie he had ever seen, and his experience with that, especially in his younger and stupid years, was extensive. There were also handcuffs, belts, ropes, and other bindings, and a long black whip. Now that was something he had no personal experience with, but he also knew this town was full of those who couldn't get enough of it. As if on cue, from somewhere down the hall, Archer heard what sounded like the crack of a whip and then a scream. He closed the doors of the armoire and kept looking around. The bed was springy and fitted with quality linens and a bedspread with intricate embroidery on it. He looked closer, but couldn't make it out. He risked turning on the lamp on the nightstand. He saw that the embroidery had created an impression of flame so colorful and real-looking that the cloth almost seemed to be on fire. With the light on, he made a closer examination of the room and even looked under the bed. There he found a small glass vial that was empty. But that wasn't entirely correct. There was a bit of residue inside, a few white grains. He sniffed it, and then pocketed it. The parts of the walls not covered with mirrors were wallpapered in a pattern that looked like purple lotus plants. He kept looking around before his gaze went back to the ceiling. The chandelier had six light fixtures, all pointing down, but only five had bulbs in them. He stood on the bed and looked at it more closely. Damn. Unless he was much mistaken, there was a camera lens in the one light post missing a bulb. He hoped to hell no one was looking at him right now. He climbed down, turned off the light, and went over to the door. Footsteps were coming. He also heard voices. A man was saying something loudly, but Archer couldn't quite make out what it was. He slipped across the room and slid under the bed. A few seconds later, the door was thrown open. He waited for them to look under the bed. But the door closed, and the footsteps moved on. Archer waited a few more minutes before he eased out into the hall. He made his way in the opposite direction of where he had come. Passing one door, he heard what sounded like Beethoven, along with soft moaning, and then a woman cried out in pain. His hand slipped to the knob. It was locked. From his wallet, Archer pulled out a lockpick. He inserted it as quietly as he could. After a few seconds of manipulations, the sounds of which were covered by Beethoven, the lock clicked free, and Archer slowly eased the door open a couple inches. The actress he had seen earlier was dressed in black lingerie. Her hands were cuffed to the bedpost. A phonograph was on a table, the classical music coming from the record rotating on it. A man with gray hair and dressed in a long robe, held a belt and struck her on the buttocks, making her yelp and stand up on her stockinged toes. Archer looked at her unfocused eyes and her sluggish features. She was clearly high on something.
"You've been bad," said the man. "You must be punished."
"Yes,"
she said breathily.
"I am bad."
Archer looked up at the chandelier and wasn't surprised to see one light bulb missing from it, too. He was sure every room had the same setup. Part of him wanted to walk in and knock the man through the wall. But the woman was there of her own free will. Still, he was about to intervene when that decision was taken away from him. He eased the door open and hurried down the hall as the sounds of footsteps and voices suddenly came back. Chapter 24. Archer ducked down another corridor as the footsteps behind him picked up momentum. He had a strong feeling now that if he were discovered, he would not be able to see the sunrise. L.A. had an abundance of lonely roads, shallow rivers, and empty concrete aqueducts in which to dump bodies. It was actually a thriving industry and created lots of jobs, but he didn't want to contribute to that particular economy. He stopped and listened, imagining himself to be a scout once more with the army in Europe. The only trouble was that was a long time ago, and a slender corridor didn't provide nearly as much room to hide as a continent. In any event, after nearly 8 years away from the army, Archer wasn't sure he was up to the task any longer. He looked quickly around and saw a door with a porthole window at eye level. He raced to it and was through the opening and closed the door behind him before the men appeared in the hall. Archer found a storage room down here, and he hid behind some boxes for a good half hour, desperately wishing he had his gun. After that, he peered out into the hall and spied another door that might be a way out. He reached it, found it opened to a stairwell, and was about to head down when he heard someone coming up. He went the other way on the stairs, reached the top floor, opened the door, and gazed quickly around. This part of the building looked unused, with crates, old draperies and beds, furniture and discarded metal equipment of various sizes and functions. Their disuse was represented by the smells of mildew, mold, and rot. He couldn't hide here, but he did spot a way out. A window. He went over to it and finally saw something in his favor. The window was difficult to raise, but he managed it. He stepped out onto the wrought iron fire escape and looked down. He figured he was gazing onto the alley at the rear of the building. He made his way down each set of fire escape steps and platforms until he reached the last one. As he slid the ladder down and dropped to the ground, he looked up in time to see a man peering down at him from the top window. A moment later, a gun was pointing at him. A second after that, it was firing at him. But Archer had already fled around the corner toward the front of the building. He could hear shouts from all over now, and his odds of escaping were slim to zero, and his final resting place might be in a hole in Chinatown, or the silty bottom of the Pacific. Neither one appealed to him. The next second, Archer ran headlong into someone, and he felt the man's fingers close around his throat. It was the struggle on the beach all over again, although this time his opponent was the doorman, and his empty knife holder apparently hadn't really been empty, because the curved blade was in his hand. Archer didn't waste a second, because he didn't have one to waste. He grabbed the knife hand and held it away from him. Next, he planted an elbow in the man's face, breaking his nose. Then he kicked his foot out and bent the man's knee the wrong way. The man went down screaming in pain, and then Archer laid him out with a crushing hook to the jaw. He had to keep thanking the army for teaching him so thoroughly how to fight, win, and stay alive to fight again. As he kept running, he looked down at his hand. It was wet. The guy's knife hadn't entirely missed. Archer had a 2-inch-long gash in his left palm. He took out his handkerchief, wound it around his hand, and kept running. Just as he got to the front entrance, the silver rolls pulled up, and the same actress staggered down the steps and into it. Archer followed right behind the lady, pushing her into the far seat and closing the door after him. The rolls sped off, the driver apparently not even aware that he had a spare passenger. Archer looked out the window in time to see the man in the gray suit hustle out of the front entrance and look around. He had obviously not seen Archer slide into the rolls. But Archer did get a good look at him. He was in his 40s, trim and hard, standing about 5'10". There was nothing particularly memorable about him, except for the sets of ugly intersecting scars across his face. Archer had been unable to see these scars when he had first arrived here, because the man had ducked away too quickly. As the Rolls turned the corner and sped up, Archer looked at the woman next to him. He wasn't sure she was aware he was there until she turned to him and said,
"Who the hell are you?"
The words were not uttered in fear or anger. She just seemed curious.
"Just hitching a ride to where I parked my car, if you don't mind. You like the Jade?"
"I go there for kicks."
"I'm sure you do. You're in pictures, right?"
Her lovely face now showed alarm. She sat up and said,
"You're not some dirty reporter, are you? So help me God, if you're with—"
She tried to hit him, but he caught her wrist an inch from his face. Archer looked toward the driver, but he was old and maybe a little hard of hearing, or he was used to arguments in the backseat of this car. Whatever the reason, he just kept looking out the windscreen and driving while the car's radio played Nat King Cole.
"Relax, lady. I don't work for any rag. I was at the Jade on my own business."
"What sort of business?"
she snapped. Archer could see why she was a star. The camera would love the angles of her face, the way her eyes widened and then brightened like precious stones before they tapered back to a dull glow that was even more interesting, and perhaps telling of what she was thinking and of a possible vulnerability, and the way her full lips quivered just so. "I'm a detective."
"What were you doing in there, then?"
"Detecting."
"Says you. I don't believe a word of it."
"Yeah, I probably wouldn't either if I were you."
He looked out the window to see where they were.
"Hey, Pops, right at the next street, and then two blocks down you can drop me."
The old man eyed him in the mirror, suddenly aware that he was there.
"Miss?"
"It's all right, Alan, just do as he says."
She looked at Archer and then her gaze dropped to his hand.
"My God, you're bleeding."
"It's nothing. Fell on a knife back there that a guy was holding."
"What happened to him?"
"When he wakes up, I'm sure he'll try to figure it out."
"Did you figure out anything back there, Mr. Detective?"
she said.
"Yeah, but the Jade's not a good place if you ask questions, or want a drink that doesn't incinerate your throat. How long you been going there for kicks?"
"Ever since I got famous. Hell, didn't you know?"
"No, I didn't. Which begs the question of why you need that kind of place now."
Archer didn't need an answer to his question. She had to go back because she couldn't not go back. But she could get her fix from anywhere, including her own studio. So what was the draw of the Jade? She seemed to know what he was thinking. She turned away from him and curled up in her furry fox stool.
"Just leave me alone."
Her voice was no longer breathless. It sounded normal and upset.
"You got a good thing going. Why mess it up?"
She looked back at him.
"If I had a choice, maybe."
"And you don't?"
"Who in this town really does, Mr. Detective?"
Archer was about to reply with something pithy and mildly scolding, but then he thought about Callahan and the casting couch.
"If a person like Liberty..."
"I see what you mean." She looked back at him, her full lips parted in pleasant surprise.
"Do you really?"
"I got friends in the business. It's got this public side with the pictures of good-looking people doing wonderful things. All the glam, the money, the homes, the yachts. Then you got the other side, which is about 90% of the pie. Like the part of the iceberg no one sees until it's too late. That part isn't pretty at all. But you know better than I ever will. It's a high price to pay, but people pay it. Lots of them." She was nodding before he stopped.
"You're cute, and smarter than you look."
"Cute men often are."
"Did you happen to see me back there?"
His grin faded.
"Back where?"
"You know where. And why else would you be advising me to quit that joint unless you saw something?"
"I saw more than maybe I needed to see. But it goes no further, I promise."
"Hell, people make promises in this town every minute of every day with no intention of ever keeping them."
She turned away.
"I came here from a little place in Minnesota. I don't want anyone to know about the Jade."
"I'm not telling anybody. And what studio owns you, by the way?"
MGM. Why?
They have a pretty decent fixer group. I know one of them. You shouldn't have to go this alone. Where are they on all this?
Nowhere, because they don't know.
And you think that's smart?
I'm actually happy about it. If they knew, the studio would make me sign a new deal, and I'd have to go to bed with the asshole who runs it again. I don't want to. I'm sick and tired of it. And he's old and married.
Who is the clown?
Never mind. There are a million just like him. So what does it matter?
You want me to talk to him for you? Lay down the law? She laughed.
What are you? A boy scout? Or a choir boy? Or both?
I have my moments. But while I have you here, he pulled out the photo of Leia. Ever seen her, the Jade? The woman looked at the photo.
Sure. A few times.
Archer looked surprised, because he was. He tapped Lamb's image. Are you sure? Take a closer look.
No, not her, the other one.
Archer gazed down at the beaming Alice Jacoby. Her? You're certain?
Didn't I just say I was?
The car slowed, and Alan said, Right here, sir? Archer looked out the window and saw the Delahaye parked across the street. That'll do, thanks, pal. He opened the door, but then looked back at her. For what it's worth, if you never go back to that place, it'll be the best thing you could ever do.
For my career?
She said, with lovely, hiked, dark eyebrows. The feeble illumination in the car seemed to make her platinum hair shimmer like descending sunlight on rippling water. No, for your life. She leaned over, nuzzled his neck, and then kissed him on the lips, running her soft hand down his jaw.
I've never had a man jump into my car before. I kind of like it.
I have to do it more often, then.
Maybe our paths will cross again.
She sounded like she was delivering a line from a bad script, but was believing every word. Not wanting to pop her drugged-up bubble, Archer finished the lousy scene by kissing her cheek and saying, You can cross my path any time, lady. He got out, and the rolls drove on. Archer knew if the woman were lucky, her career would last until this time next year. If she were unlucky, she'd be dead by the end of the month. And they'd find 100 just as lovely and breathless to take her place, no problem. The Midwest alone was turning them out like GM did cars. Archer left Chinatown behind with a lot to think about and make sense of. He needed some more peroxide and a bandage, and, most critically, a drink. A real one. And Archer knew exactly the lady he wanted to have that drink with. Chapter 25
I'll have to play a nurse in one of my next pictures, Archer. I mean, look at all the practice I'm getting with you.
Callahan had washed the slash in his hand, dabbed enough peroxide on it to make the hairs on Archer's neck stand up and salute, and then applied ointment and a bandage, winding it around his wrist and tying it off. He had told her some of his adventures from the night, and she kept shaking her head and warning him that the next time might not be so easy for him. Yet her look was far more worried than her words. I didn't think this one was easy, he said.
Who was the actress? I'm just wondering if that's her lipstick on your collar.
She was a little loose with her affections. Comes with the drugs. I don't remember her name. She was a platinum blonde and curvy and appropriately breathless.
Well, that narrows it down to just about everybody. You sure you can't remember a picture she was in or something?
I don't go to the movies all that often. Sort of a waste of time for me.
Thanks, Archer, a lot.
I didn't mean it that way. Anyway, she said she was with MGM. The fixer there doesn't know about the Jade. At least, that's what she said. She also said if they did know, they'd use it to blackmail her into a new deal, and she'd have to sleep with the studio head again.
And what? You're surprised by that?
But if she keeps going back there, her career is going to be over because she's going to croak.
Maybe she wants that.
She had a fur coat and a Rolls with a chauffeur, and she was maybe our age.
At first, it's the money and fame, and it's great. But then all that takes a back seat, because they've all got the damn burrs and a Rolls with a driver. It's a lot of pressure, Archer. Some folks get to the top and suddenly realize they don't want to be there. They don't want to have to keep doing what it takes to stay there. She just might be looking for a way out. I just hope she's breathing when she finds it.
He flexed his injured hand and then mixed himself a whiskey and soda and a gin and tonic for Callahan. He handed hers over and said, but her only way out might be a grave. Callahan sat in a chair with one long leg elegantly crossed over the other and sipped her drink.
She wouldn't be the first, and she won't be the last.
That's pretty tough, he finally said.
I know it, but I'm not a star, Archer. No one's trying to hook me on drugs and that bondage stuff. I'm not valuable enough.
And if you ever get that valuable?
Then I'll have to deal with it. But that's a long road, at least for me.
And somebody's taking pictures of her. I saw the camera. Callahan thought for a moment and said,
maybe that's why she keeps going back.
So the Jade is blackmailing her?
This is L.A., Archer. Somebody is always blackmailing someone else.
He looked at his drink and shook his head. This place stinks right down to the core.
And still you keep coming back. And it's not just to see me.
There is a certain intoxication with the place. I'll admit that. Plus, the cases here are more original.
Can't get that same high in Baytown. Because, in a way, you're an addict, too.
Keep going, Liberty. I'm not nearly depressed enough yet.
So, Alice Jacoby goes to the Jade? But she told you she'd never heard of it.
The lady tonight was on drugs. Maybe she was mistaken. But she seemed pretty sure. And if so, Jacoby lied to me.
What would Jacoby be doing at the Jade?
She struck me as being pretty straight-laced, but sometimes it's those very same ones who end up being the wild spirits. He took out the vial he'd found in one of the rooms. I got a pretty good idea what's in here. Callahan looked at it.
What?
Heroin. They bring it in from Mexico, mostly.
So what are you going to do now?
Sleep. I haven't done a lot of that in the last couple of days. Hey, can you do one thing for me? The gal checking people in at the Mars's party?
Donna? What about her?
Can you talk to her and see if Lamb ever showed? I have to be really certain about it.
Sure, I can do that.
She rose and sat on the arm of his chair, running a hand gently over his head, avoiding the bandaged part.
Is it really worth it, Archer? I mean, like you said, you make just a fraction of what I do standing up in front of a camera and regurgitating someone else's words. And no one's trying to kill me while I'm doing it. Hardly seems fair.
I'm reasonably good at being a PI. I enjoy the work, and I hope I'm doing a little bit of good. As he heard himself say these words, Archer wondered if any of them were really true. She stopped rubbing his hair.
And if you end up getting killed?
Then you can miss me. She frowned.
That's not funny. You're the only real friend I've got.
Then you need to get out more. He rose. Go to sleep. You're on set tomorrow,